Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you so very much for taking the time to listen. I do appreciate you. And as always, feel free to reach out to Jeff at beekeepingfornewbies.com. That's N-E-W-B-E-E-S.com. Well, everybody, I hope that you're taking care of yourselves and that you're staying safe. I was watching a video, I think it was maybe a day or two ago. I think it was about 2 days ago. And it was showing some of the ice storms out in Kansas City, Missouri. And of course, this is going on. This was early. I think that was one of the earlier areas that this ice storm hit. But I was watching all of these people just sliding everywhere. You know, I'll drive in the snow all day long. I've been a snow lover since I was old enough to see snow and know what it was. I remember being a kid and my parents waking me up and being like, "Hey, it's snowing outside. Come take a look," and going to the window and just... I still get excited about snow. I think it's just a cool thing. And I know everybody up the north is like, "We've had enough snow, for the love of God, just bring the sun back out." But ice is such bad news. I mean, driving in ice to me, like, I'll drive all day long, foot of snow, whatever, don't care. As soon as that ice comes out, I'm going nowhere. And I'm watching all of these people driving on the interstate going, and I'm like, why in the world would you go out in those conditions? But, you know, I guess, you know, some people still have to go to work. Things still have to get done. You got to take that chance. But man, you are really putting your life in your own hands there. But anyway, I hope everybody is staying safe out there. I hope you are getting into your new 2025 routine. And I know my 2025 routine is going to be the same one that I've been running for about the past two decades or so. It's the one where I say, hey, like, this year I'm really going to buckle down and get myself in shape. And then as I'm preparing for that, I go grab a big slice of carrot cake and contemplate the best way to go at that plan. And then eat more junk food. And, you know, so we'll see what happens. Anyway, let's get down to business here. I'll ramble all day talking about things that nobody probably cares about anyway. So today we are going to be on episode 123. As we talked last week, we're doing kind of a new little series designed really for new beekeepers who are saying, like, okay, this is my first year coming up. I'm trying to go through the checklist, figure out what I need to do, make sure I'm getting everything prepared. So last week we were talking about step one is like researching the laws, ordinances, requirements, any registration issues, all those things that are relating to you being able to legally place bees on your property, your business, you know, wherever you're trying to do this. Making sure that you've done your due diligence so that you don't go out and buy a bunch of bees and find out that you're not allowed to have them without a signed permission slip from your neighbor or whatever it might be. If you haven't seen episode 122, go back and check that out. That's the first one in this new little series we're running. I think it's going to be 25 to 30 different episodes, starting with where we are with, you know, researching laws, where to prep your yard, or where to place bees in your yard, how to prep your yard, all the way up through, okay, everybody, your bees just got here today. Let's talk about how we're going to get them installed. We're going to try and get you all the way through that over the next couple of months. So today we are focusing on prepping the yard and getting everything where it needs to be. Now, I recognize that everybody's yard is different. The conditions where they live are different. For example, if you're on a hill on a mountaintop facing west, your options are a bit more limited. Like, you're going to catch a westerly breeze, but we'll still talk about things that you can do to kind of help mitigate some of the things that may be a part of that wester or northwesterly wind. But I'm going to kind of just run through a little checklist I have, hit some of the highlights, have a little bit of some commentary in there. As you're going through this in your yard, don't overthink it, okay? You know, it's difficult. I always tell people whenever we have these discussions, I'm always saying, look, go out into the wild, look at what bees do in the wild and try to mimic that, right? Well, you're not going to, you know, find a dead tree that you cut down, and then you cut a, you know, 3-foot section out of the middle of it and stick it in your yard and try to find a way to stick frames in it or whatever. You're not going to do that. But if you look at what bees are doing in the wild, anytime you can mimic that kind of a habitat that they would establish for themselves, whether it's inside of a tree or inside of a house or a building or a container or whatever it might be, if you can mimic that in some way, then you can hopefully provide a space that they will enjoy and be happy and be able to flourish in. It's kind of difficult in random spots in your yard because beehives naturally don't show up in the middle of your yard, as an example. Let's say you have a square property that is 1 acre. So I don't know how you put this in, the best way to do this in, let's say, feet or meters. But let's say maybe your property was just to keep it really simple, it would be, let's say, 300 feet by 300 feet or 100 meters by 100 meters. And you just make that into a square. If your house is right smack in the middle of that and the rest of it is completely open land, well, there would never be a beehive there. The beehive is not going to just be in the middle of open land. So by that nature itself, there's no protection from other trees around. There's nothing else that would be like its habitat. So you're already doing something different anyway. The best thing is just to try to find something that you can make that is as habitable and hospitable to them as possible. So let's go into the first one here, some of the kind of key considerations for your yard. When you're choosing a spot, and again, what I do is what works for me. That's what I'm telling you. I'm not saying that if you do it differently from what I tell you that it won't work. I'm just telling you what's worked well for me. The first thing I would tell you is you want to be thinking about a spot. Like, I've always noticed that if I've had bees, as an example, facing east and south, right? If I had two colonies literally back to back, well, 90 degrees, you know, one facing east, one facing south. When that morning sun hits the hive entrance, it seems like that just gets them going a little bit earlier. There just seems to be a little bit of a bump in how, you know, accelerates their kind of morning wake up. Outside of that, I don't see a big difference between, let's say, south and east. Now, I do, you know, being in the prevailing westerlies where I am, and all of my storms come from basically in the summertime, it's like the south and the west. In the wintertime, you have that cool air coming out of the west and the northwest. So I generally will always face my bees like in a south, southeast, or even easterly, if possible. Another reason that I do this is because most of my thunderstorms will also come from the west, northwest, southwest, but typically it's going to be a west or a southwest. So having the hives facing east or southeast prevents that driving rain from kind of being, you know, literally driven up into the entrance of the hive. But I typically will slant my hives slightly forward anyway. So even if some water does come in, the bees will drink the water. Whatever is excess will just run out. Now, there are times when, you know, I drop a pallet and I've got four hives facing four different directions. And it might be, you know, let's say I brought some to my house for whatever reason, dropped a pallet wherever I can put it. They're going to have to deal with whatever they got. If I stick that pallet in the back of my truck and I take it down to my apiary, they're going to face a different direction. If I, you know, took them to somebody's house, there's a thing I'm doing now where I'm doing a kind of like a service model for bees where people can get honeybees at their house. They don't have to maintain them. They don't have to take care of them. But I kind of come in and teach them a little bit and show them how to do things. But it's like an as a service kind of model, like a subscription model. But anyway, if I drop one of those colonies off at somebody's yard, you know, we're going to face it whatever direction is going to make sense based on the conditions there. So it's not always going to be the same way. But I try to get that south, southeast kind of direction. Another thing to consider when you're selecting that spot is what your ground is going to be. A lot of people will say, well, this is the spot where I'm putting my beehives. I'm going to, let's say, for example, throw a tarp down. You can throw a tarp down to kind of keep a lot of the undergrowth and the grass from growing up. And then, of course, you would have to manage whatever falls on top of the tarp. But at least you're kind of preventing some of the weeds and things from coming up. I know a lot of folks have used cardboard. You can get, there was a young lady out of Oregon, I think, who emailed me a long time ago, had some really great suggestions for going to appliance companies and getting big, like, hot water heater boxes, cutting those open and putting those down like every couple of years underneath of her hives and in her garden areas. I think she was using them in her garden and then cutting a hole where she planted her plants. But that whole area around it was completely surrounded by this thick cardboard that the weeds couldn't grow through. So figuring out what you want to do with that. You can do stone. A lot of people have come through and put a bunch of gravel down, put their stands on gravel. Nothing wrong with that as well. The one thing that I would say to consider with this, well, I guess there's two things that immediately come to mind. One of them, of course, is with weeds, because as weeds and grass and things grow, you're going to have to trim it. So I recommend putting on your bee gear and, you know, going around with the weed eater and trim everything up. The other consideration is with the hive beetle. So hive beetles, you know, they would fly into your hive, and then they're going to go find a place to lay an egg. They definitely want to lay them anywhere they can find a crack or a crevice or a spot. If they can get it into the brood, they'll put it in the brood. If they can put it, you know, in an area that the bees are having trouble getting into, wherever they can lay their eggs, they're going to lay their eggs. Now, we're going to dive a little deeper again and revisit some things with how destructive hive beetles are. But when they lay those eggs and they emerge, you're going to have these little tiny little worms crawling around. They kind of look like small little maggot type worms crawling around. And they are very destructive. They will eat your pollen, your honey. They'll tear everything apart. The bees can manage them when you have a small number. But when you really get a big infestation, it can be a huge challenge. But what happens with those young larvae that'll crawl around and gorge themselves on whatever the bees have, they'll then walk out the door, drop onto the ground, and go into the ground an inch or so, maybe a couple of inches. And they will pupate in the ground for about a month, month and a half. And then they will emerge as a new hive beetle. Well, if you're not giving them that space to go into the ground, like maybe you have cardboard, going back to, again, the cardboard, the tarp, the gravel, you know, things that they can't get into to actually pupate, that might be, you know, something that you would want to consider. But either way, just be mindful of how the hive beetle reproduces. That would be helpful to know as you're thinking about this. Now, in addition to that location, I really like to pay attention to, like, for example, my property is kind of a low-lying area. It's a little bit swampy, and I've graded most of it. And once the grasses came in and you know, drank a lot of the moisture that was in the soil, it was pretty easy to find good spots to put hives. But I remember my first year there, everything was newly disturbed. There were no more trees or small bushes or grasses or anything drinking up all of that, the liquid that was in the soil, the moisture. And of course, there were all trees, so there was no sunlight getting down to the ground. And so, if there was any imperfection in the ground at all, it would become a puddle. And I had dropped a couple pallets down. And I realized that, you know, to get to them, I'm literally walking through a puddle. I didn't plan too well with that a long time ago. So trying to get your hives a little bit up off the ground, you know, in slightly higher ground. It doesn't have to be, you know, 4, 5, 6 feet higher than everything around it, but just making sure that it's up a little bit. So if you did have a couple of days of some really heavy rain, you're not going to have to walk through a puddle to get to the hive. Now, it is certainly good to have water sources available, and that's something that you want to consider, you know, when you're placing your hives. There are a lot of people who will either buy some kind of a commercial watering thing. I don't do that. I mean, you can rely on what's in nature. So where I am, I'm in a very humid environment. You know, every night I wake up in the morning, there's dew on the ground everywhere. Every time it rains, rain gets captured, you know, in leaves and little things around, you know, around the yard and just within the habitat itself. I don't have supplemental water out for my bees. Now, if we were in a drought situation, things were really, really dry for several weeks, we're not getting any rain, you're going to want to think about that, because bees absolutely have to have water. So if you wanted to do that, a lot of people will take a container, drop a bunch of rocks in the container to give the bees something to stand on, and then they'll just fill it up every day or so. You do need to pay attention for mosquitoes, because mosquitoes will go in there, lay their eggs. Now you have mosquito larvae and you're creating a nice little mosquito breeding ground. There are certain tablets that you can put into water that I guess are a deterrent or something that will kill mosquito larvae. I never use them because I don't want my bees to drink whatever that is. It might be perfectly safe. I haven't researched it. I just let the bees kind of find it in the wild. But if you are in a situation where, like I said, things are really dry, you can consider just actually using a feeder with water in it. So you could do a jar feeder, a frame feeder. You could do whatever you needed to do. But you definitely want to be switching that out, especially if it's really, really hot in the summertime. You don't want algae growing in there and things getting gross. But if you needed to for some reason, like I said, put some in a feeder, put it on a jar on top or whatever you needed to do. I definitely recommend outside if possible. If you just change that water every other day, the mosquito larvae shouldn't be an issue.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance. Like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Another reason that I do like to have it be well-drained around those hives is because of the fact I'm usually bringing some kind of equipment through, even if it's my smaller little tractor, you know, or maybe even a lawn tractor when you're cutting the grass. You want to make sure that you're not falling into dips and holes and all of that. So just trying to get a nice, good, level spot. And like I said, we're going to generally target some kind of like a south, southeasterly placement if you have the choice. And another thing to kind of keep in mind is the bees are going to come out of the hive and they generally start moving up pretty quickly. But you do want to give them a little bit of a flight path. Like if you have a driveway and you're like, hey, this is going to be really cool for people to be able to like drive down the driveway and watch the bees flying in and out. Well, if your car is parked right there in the driveway as you're moving and the hive is right off the driveway, it's going to be kind of weird. They're going to fly out and like fly into people's cars or weird things. Like, you just give them a little bit of space. Give them kind of like a nice little takeoff room and some landing room. You know, just give them a little bit of a wide berth so they can kind of get in and out. But also keeping in mind, since we're on that subject a little bit, is not placing them in areas where people are traveling a lot. I think I've told this story before, but I have a, I don't know, it's probably about 100, maybe 150 foot driveway from the road to where I hit a circle at my house. It was like a circular driveway. In the middle of that circle, I had two hives one year. And I remember like the Amazon person pulled up and stopped at the beginning of the circle and like they dropped the box like on the side of the, in the grass. They're like, I can't go any closer. I don't want to get stung. They were really kind of freaked out about it. 95% of people never even noticed it, just, you know, kept on going. But you got to keep in mind that some people aren't going to be as excited about honeybees as you are. So trying to keep them out of the way, and again, making sure that that adheres to whatever your local rules are, your local rules, ordinances, or whatever may say, you can't even have them in the front yard, or they must be at least 50 feet from walkways. So with all of that in mind, I go out and I look around looking for a level space. I want something that has good, easy access for equipment, because I might not be using equipment right now. I may be thinking like, hey, this is a great spot. I'm, you know, maybe you're somebody in your 20s, 30s, 40s, whatever. You're young, healthy, fit. You're like, I can move this stuff around. I don't need any kind of equipment. Cool. Well, at least make it big enough to bring a cart in. Like I have this little basic little cart that you can kind of roll around in the yard. I just call it the yard cart. And if you wanted to put things in that, you still want to be able to move it in and out easily. But making space for, if you have a lot of hives, let's say you're building up and this is your year, you're going to 20, 30, 40. You may want to start moving some things around in a truck, or you may bring feeds and things out in a large container. You may have sugar syrup mixed in a large container or a tote. You want to just drive through next to the hives and be able to feed from them, or feed from the truck. So providing space to move in, around, and about definitely makes a lot of sense. Now, another thing you're going to want to remember is, or at least consider, I should say, is the idea of some fencing or some type of barrier. The obvious scenario would be if you live in an area where, you know, it's bear country, you're going to want to get an electric fence. Now these, we should probably do a separate discussion on setting up a bear fence, but they're really not that hard. You're going to need at least one, preferably multiple ground stakes that your negative side of everything will ground to, grounding rods. And then you'll have some kind of a staking system that will go into the ground that is insulated, that you'll run your wire around. You'll have other wires that connect rows 1, 2, 3, and maybe 4 all together so that you have conduction across all of it. And then you'll use some kind of a fence charger, which is, when they say charger, they're not thinking like battery charger. It's like to electrically charge the fence. And the recommendations I've heard is you want 1 joule of energy or more of a charger to deter bears. So you definitely want to consider that if that's something you have to contend with in your area. So, you know, bears, skunks, raccoons, you know, any of those things will mess with a hive, particularly if it's weaker for whatever reason, or they think they can, you know, they're desperate. They do what they got to do. You know, most bears should be kind of retired for the season by now, but that doesn't obviously have anything to do with the rest of the year. They can go in there anytime in the spring, summer, fall. In addition to electric fencing, you may just want to have a physical barrier type of fence. Putting up a fence, even if it's, again, a very basic, you know, what do you call it, like field fence or anything, just something that provides a barrier that you can hang a sign from that says, caution, honeybees. And then that way, if somebody decides to hop the fence or, you know, break into the fence somehow, they harass your bees, they get stung, you're like, look, I put up a fence, I put up a sign, I'm sorry that they decided to do what they did. But definitely some kind of signage in your yard, because like I mentioned before, there's always liability issues that are going to present themselves. You don't want to give somebody an open door to give you a hard time or to sue you. So just think about that as well. Now, another barrier option that you could consider, I know some people have done this out west and in some of your colder climates, but you can actually build a like a fence wall, like a physical barrier fence type of thing, maybe 5-6 feet tall around your hives, maybe covered on three sides. So that you still have good access up to and around, but you're providing like a windbreak all the way around it. I've even seen some people that have planted like Leyland cypress or boxwoods or other things around the area they've designated for their honeybees, and it provides kind of a natural windbreak with those larger bushes. So those are some things to consider too if you're in an area that is subject to a lot of high winds and really, you know, colder wind chills and everything. Now, there's another discussion that people like to have a lot around, should I put my bees in direct sun or should I put my bees in the shade? I don't want to say it's necessarily one of those religious things that people get angry about, but people definitely take a position on this. And a lot of people feel like having their bees in full sun provides a generally drier environment inside the hive, so you have lower issues with fungal growth or molds or things like that. They've also said that it makes it more difficult for the hive beetle larvae to survive, you know, when they're exiting and they're trying to get down to the ground. It makes it a little bit more difficult for them. So the hive beetle doesn't do as well in direct sun. So those are some considerations. I have done both. I have not done it really from like a scientific standpoint. Like I haven't put one yard where every hive is in the shade and then gone, you know, 5-10 miles away and had another yard where all of them are in the sun, and then made actual measurements and pulled real data to say one way or another. I'm going to try to pay attention to it. I've got a list of notes of all these things I'm supposed to be watching and paying attention for to report back to everybody. But I honestly have not noticed a big difference in the presence or absence of beetles, pests, or anything like that. But I do think that there is something with it as it relates to just general moisture and maybe even possible some fungal things. I've had a couple of fungal things that have shown up in the hive where it's almost like a mold or something that gets it just because it's a humid environment already. And then being in the shade, you know, that can introduce some challenges, that's kind of why. And a lot of people, I'm going to go off on a little bit of a tangent here, but a lot of people get really weird about screened bottom boards. I really love the screened bottom boards in the summertime because it allows additional airflow. And, you know, air moving is a good thing to me, especially when you have those 95, 98 degree summer days Fahrenheit. So I guess it's going to be like, what, like 37, 38, 39 Celsius. You have those really hot days. You need some airflow moving. Yes, the bees are going to be down at the entrance and they're going to be fanning, and that's great. But having airflow is not a bad thing for just general ventilation and cooling of the hive, but also to kind of reduce some of that moisture. So I think there are some advantages to having at least partial shade. So I think that might be your answer, is finding something that has a balance where maybe you get a little shade in the morning, a little shade in the evening, and 4 to maybe 7 hours of sun during the day, something like that. I don't have a real scientific answer to give you for that one. I haven't seen anything that really jumps out at me, but I'll try to pay better attention in the coming years here to provide some more scientific information around that. Now, we've talked about the laws, and we've talked about location. We talked about in your yard, keeping things away from fence lines, driveways, walkways, your neighbors. We've talked about not putting things in places where it's hard to get to. We've talked about which direction we may face. We've talked windbreaks, lots of different things that we've gone into with that. The one thing we kind of haven't covered, and it's sort of in that whole should I be beekeeping here at this place or not subject, is the forage of your area. Now, this is another great thing to discuss with the bee club. It's great to say, hey, I just moved to fill in the blank city, wherever. I'm joining the local bee club. Hey, guys, what's the forage like in this area or that area? Oh, you should talk to Jane. She lives over in that neighborhood. And, you know, you have a discussion with Jane and say, hey, what do you see? What's, you know, what kind of honey production do you have? How many colonies do you have? Do you know other beekeepers in the area? An area can only support so much activity. If you have a community kind of like mine, I know that I've got, well, I will have some more here back at the house this year, but I know I've got within 5 miles of my house, there's at least 20 or 25 hives that I know of. That's fine for the size of the land and the area and the number of trees and everything that are here. There are a lot of trees in this neighborhood. There's a lot of mature old hardwoods, a lot of oaks. So the forage is really solid here in the spring. It's pretty dismal in the fall, but it's decent in the spring. But being able to get a little bit of an idea of how things are in your area is definitely something that you would want to consider. So probably talking to someone at the bee club, doing a little bit of research. And, you know, as an example, like if you moved in and you were my new neighbor across the street and you said, hey, I'm thinking about keeping honeybees, what do you know? I would be able to give you kind of the lay of the land. I would say, hey, you're going to have a really big spring ramp up and you should be able to get enough honey to last throughout, you know, the entire year into the next spring. You're going to have a dearth in the summertime, somewhere between early to mid-June and early to mid-August. Probably going to want a supplemental feed during that time. And especially if you take honey, you're definitely going to have to supplemental feed. And then you're probably going to need a supplemental feed again in September, maybe early October, depending on the fall flow. The fall flow here, specifically at my house, is usually fairly weak. The fall flow down at the apiary property is pretty good. It's actually a really solid fall flow down there. But having that discussion with anybody who's near you who can bring some value to what you're trying to do is worth the time. Now, we've talked, again, I keep recapping this because I want to make sure that we're covering everything. It's kind of a mental thing for me, so please play along at home. But we've got everything kind of figured out now, right? We know the lay of the land. We know what we're looking at, what we're dealing with, what our considerations are. But there's one more thing that we probably ought to start thinking about and trying to nail down. So I did a short video, YouTube short the other day, and it was these old hive stands I have. Because in my first couple years of beekeeping, I read something where it was like, oh, you don't want anything that has any chemicals that could be, you know, coming in contact with your bees. So like when you paint everything, you only paint the outside, you don't paint the insides. And I think that, I don't know if I had read it somewhere or if I just thought it myself. I really don't remember. It's been a long time, like 15 years or whatever. But I remember thinking I shouldn't be using pressure treated lumber because of the chemicals used in the treatment process. I don't want my bees on that, like on that wood. And even though I can still paint it and that would provide protection, I don't know. For whatever reason, I just didn't feel good about it. So I used regular 2x4s for the legs of these stands. And these stands are old, like Brushy Mountain Bee Supply, if you guys remember those. That was a good company. I used to buy a lot of woodware from them, but they closed down several years ago. But these stands were Brushy Mountain stands, and it had a nice little ramp on the front. And when you put your bottom board down, the bottom board lined up perfectly. It was a really good setup. But these 2x4 legs that I made were just regular non-treated 2x4s. And I knew that by sitting down on the ground, they were eventually going to rot out. The water, the moisture, just sitting there in the ground was going to, you know, eat away at them. And what I would do with them is about every other year, I would grab the circular saw and just trim off 2 or 3 inches off the bottom. And that was it. I have not used these, I'm going to say, I don't know, 5-7 years. I haven't used them in forever, but I saw one sitting by my shed and I thought, you know what? I might use this year at the house. Let me go ahead and fix these legs. And of course, multiple people responded, why don't you just use treated lumber? And I'm like, I was trying not to get the chemicals around the bees. But anyway, if you're deciding that you're going to use some kind of a stand, you want to make sure that you're considering the type of lumber you're using. Like, I'm not going to tell you one way or another. I'm not going to tell you use pressure treated, don't use pressure treated, because I don't really have an answer. I don't know if it's possible if a honeybee moves around and walks around on a pressure treated piece of wood, is there any exposure they can get from those chemicals? I don't think so. I don't think they're, you know, eating and consuming that wood. I don't think it's an issue. I'm not going to do it because I don't need to. I have better ways of doing this. Like I said, that was a year one, year two kind of setup that I did, and I haven't gone back to it. I liked it because it was about probably a foot and a half, like 14 inches off the ground. It was a good level to work with the bees, provided plenty of clearance to cut the grass, and it worked. And I don't think there's anything wrong with using pressure-treated legs, but I didn't do it. What I do now that I like a lot is taking center blocks, and there's a couple different ways you can do these, but the way that I like is to put one center block down lengthwise, and so it would be like as I'm facing it, the longer end is moving away from me, kind of, not perpendicular to me. And then you can either go from there, or you can go from there, add another one 8 feet to the left or the right of that, and then put 2 4x4 posts all the way across. That's one way to do it. Some people will then add a second one to get a little bit more height and then do the 2 4x4 posts. Some people will stand them up, where they will actually stand them upright. You know how the center blocks have those two big holes in the middle of them? They'll stand them upright, put two of them together, and then put the 4x4s, one in each of the top holes. Now, I know this might be difficult to kind of just visualize here, but I'm going to be doing a video about this. I have two videos that I'm going to do in the next week, fingers crossed here, if this rain goes away and the weather gets decent. But I'm going to be showing you exactly what this looks like in my yard. I've done some preliminary footage of the yard, kind of with some ideas I have. And then I'm going to go through the yard with about 5 different setups and show you what they look like, why I like them, why I would or would not use them. So kind of do the best you can to follow along with me right now, but we'll have something visual that you can assign to this here in the next week or so. But cinder blocks are great. If you just took 2 center blocks, set them down, put a bottom board on top of that, and put your hive on top of that, you're fine. It makes it really, really easy. Unfortunately, one of our members up in Pennsylvania had a big wind come through the other day and just blew his hives over, which is so terrible. I've had it happen, and it's just, oh my God, like you work so hard every day, all year long, to get your bees to this point where you're like, okay, we just have like 2 or 3 more months. Guys, hang in there, or gals, hang in there. And to have a wind come through and blow that over, right? So in that scenario, if he was using the cinder block style or something, you know, similar to that, you just wrap a big strap over the top, hook it onto the cinder blocks, and, you know, it's locked in and not going anywhere. But again, you know, I don't think about that. My first couple years beekeeping, I was like, well, this thing is heavy. It's got a lot of weight. There's no way this thing is going to blow over. And what ended up happening is they had so much heavy honey stored up top. And as they were working their way up, you had all this kind of top weight, and it just took a little bit of a topple. And I've had them fall, especially some of my nukes. I had nukes that fell. I devised a couple of different strategies over the years with basically taking like a furring strip, or like a strip of maybe 3/4 inch thickness by maybe, I don't know, 2 inches wide by like 5 feet long, 6 feet long. And I would lay that across multiple hives and just staple it to the top of them. So now you'd have 5 or 6 hives that are all stapled together. And then at the end of that, you know, put a little bit of a strap that pulls it down to the ground. So you're getting that, you know, left to right movement, and they're all kind of attached to each other. I've done some goofy things over the years. And sometimes I've just done something spontaneous where you're looking at this and you go, well, that doesn't look good and I don't have anything with me. And you're going to have to improvise. So if you're the person who likes to be crafty and improvise things and come up with new creative ways of doing things, beekeeping will definitely keep you on your toes with that. But yeah, cinder blocks are great. 4x4 posts are great. You can put 4x4 posts. You can just literally lay them on the ground, put your bottom boards on top of those if you want. You can do cinder block, 4x4, bottom board. Pallets are always popular. You know, the bottoms of pallets will rot out over time, which kind of stinks. But, you know, if that happens, you just got to rotate them out every now and then. Or you could even put down, you know, a couple of 4x4 posts and then, you know, treated 4x4 posts, and then set your pallet on top of that if you wanted to. There's just whatever you can imagine, have at it. I think there was one person, while I think it was an interesting idea, I wouldn't do it because I feel like it's cost prohibitive, but he mentioned like plastic dipping, like you take, you know, wood or chain or whatever, you dip it in like a liquid plastic that hardens And when it dries, it completely seals everything up. And that's a really cool, it's a neat thing. I wouldn't spend the money. I wouldn't make the investment to do it, but it's really neat. There was also another person who mentioned getting some dunnage, like some of the large blocks of wood that are treated. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not, but they're large blocks of wood that a lot of shippers will use when they're delivering things to and from local businesses and things. And, you know, that dunnage would be great to be something you could put underneath. Again, be creative. Think outside the box. As always, if you're hanging out and you're brainstorming, you're like, man, I have no idea what I'm going to do with this. Shoot me an email. Go into our Discord room, right? We have a whole lot of people in the Discord room who are always coming up with cool, creative, new ideas. Like, my brain's kind of hit or miss. Like, sometimes I can really get creative, and other times, you know, I'm just like staring at the screen or the wall with the little drool coming out or whatever. It's just, it's really, I'm hit or miss. So everyone, I think I'm going to go ahead and wrap that up. I know that I haven't covered every single little possible thing that you can consider, but, you know, just walk through your yard, go through a walk, look around, think about where it just makes sense. Go out to the end of your driveway or wherever you might be, walk in from that position and look around and say, okay, if I'm walking up as a person who's scared to death of bees, doesn't want to get stung, has an allergy, whatever it might be, what would I flip out about if I walked into the yard and saw a hive here, there, or wherever? If you would, do me a favor, please go and check out the YouTube channel. It's just at Beekeeping for Newbies on YouTube. Take a look around. Let me know what you need. Let me know what areas that you're struggling with. Like I said, I've got a couple videos teed up that are tied to this series that we're working on right now. But let me know the things that you need to see, because as I'm putting things together, sometimes it's really easy to just do a quick video on something that someone has an immediate need for. I want to get as much relevant information out there as quickly as possible, because I know that once we hit April, May, it's going to be crazy. So let me know how I can better support you all. We've made some pretty massive investments in getting the right equipment in place. I got this new thing that I'm really excited about. One area I struggled with is I used to do videos of me doing inspections, and I'd have a GoPro like mounted to my chest. And like the first time I used it, I was really excited. I had a lot of cool things happen. And I was like, oh my God, this is so amazing. And then I went and played back the footage, and it was like a 45-minute groin shot. And I'm like, okay, I don't think anybody wants to see that. So then I tried again, and I finally got to a point where you could see fairly well. Audio was absolutely atrocious, so I had to figure that out separately, which I think I've got a handle on that now. But the other problem was I could never give you like a good zoomed in picture of something, and I could never move around really well because I always had to have some hand doing something else, whether it was holding a mic or holding a camera or whatever. I've got this thing now that actually follows me. I can put it on a little base on a tripod and get the right angle on it, and it will literally follow me as I move around. And I'm really hoping that that makes things better. But let me know what you need. And as always, you can feel free, drop me an email, let me know what's going on, what you need a hand with. And our next episode I'm going to do is definitely going to be applicable. It's still kind of considered to be part of this, you know, episode three of this little series we're doing. But we're really going to talk about varroa mites. We're going to talk about how critically important that this is, because this is going to be your showstopper issue. We're going to talk about that in the next episode. I'm probably going to record it today, and I'd like to get it released this Friday. But Guys, gals, everybody, like, please take this seriously. I'm telling you, oh my God, I was so like, yeah, whatever about it. So many people don't take varroa seriously and they pay the price for it. Don't let all your hard work be for nothing because of this stupid little bug, okay? So that's our next episode. That's going to be episode 123. Ooh, I mislabeled things. That'll be episode 124. All right, everybody, take care. Be kind to one another. And remember that I love you. And there's nothing you can do about it. We'll talk to you soon.
Americans love using their credit cards, the most secure and hassle-free way to pay. But D.C. politicians want to change that with the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. This bill lets corporate megastores pick how your credit card is processed, allowing them to use untested payment networks that jeopardize your data security and rewards. Corporate megastores will make more money, and you pay the price. Tell Congress to guard your card, because Americans lose when politicians choose. Learn more at guardyourcard.com.